Morning. We have three cases on our oral argument docket this morning. We understand counsel in two of those cases have announced ready and declared the time that they wish to take for their argument. That being the case, we'll call FWT Inc. versus Haskin Wallace Mason Property.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Morning.
This is a case about one contract between two parties, the appellant FWT Inc. and the appellee Haskin Wallace. It's about one contract between these two parties covering one piece of property, which is 6 acres in Kennedale, Texas, that was conveyed in a 1997 deed. Everyone in this case agrees that contract is unambiguous. Texas law is well settled that it will enforce unambiguous contracts among parties according to their terms. The position Haskin advocates here is asking this court, as it asked the trial court, to rewrite the agreement of the parties, and that was the error committed by the trial court below. The issue in this case is whether the court will hold sophisticated parties to the terms of their bargain in an arm's-length transaction when there is an unambiguous contract. There's few facts in this matter, and they are all undisputed. They are that in 1997, 6 acres was conveyed by FWT to Haskin in a deed containing a right of first refusal. In 2007, a third party called Valmont proposed a transaction to Haskin and other entities. That transaction included that Valmont would lease and/or buy the property in Kennedale. Haskin then provided notice to FWT. FWT provided timely notice of its exercise of its right of first refusal, and Haskin then refused to convey the property to FWT. The offer accepted by FWT was identical to the offer proposed by Valmont for the property, and that is conveyance of the 6 acres by lease according to a terms of $25,000 per month with a purchase option of $2.5 million. The import of the trial court's ruling in this case is that FWT has to pay $16.5 million, acquire the property in Kennedale, acquire property in Hearst, acquire assets of two ongoing businesses, and likewise enter into contracts with parties that were strangers to the deed, or forego its bargained for and memorialized right of first refusal. Instead of closing on the property, Haskin filed a declaratory judgment action. Essentially, Haskin says in its declaratory complaint and later in its motion for summary judgment that FWT has to complete the entire transaction or FWT has waived its right of first refusal. FWT responds that it simply must only buy the property and the right of first refusal triggered the sale and FWT is entitled to specific performance. The trial court did not apply Texas law regarding unambiguous contracts. And the principle of applying the terms of those contracts are embodied in the few Texas cases that address what are called package transactions. And the first case I'd like to discuss is the Navasota case. The petition was recently denied by the Texas Supreme Court in that case. The appellee here, Haskin, filed an amicus brief there. And at the present time, a request for a rehearing of the petition is pending before the Supreme Court. Navasota involved a preferential right on mineral acreage in East Texas called the Hilltop Prospect. A party offered to buy that acreage, and it included two other terms. Those terms were, one, the purchase of stock in an affiliate of the seller, and two, entry into a 13-county area of mutual interest. When notice was provided to Navasota, Navasota elected to exercise. The response by the other party, which was Chesapeake, was basically that you can only exercise if you agree to the terms of the stock sale and to enter into the 13-county area of mutual interest. A lawsuit followed. The issue was whether Chesapeake, or really the seller, could in fact force Navasota to agree to these other terms. The court went through an analysis of Texas cases involving package deals and recognized that proposed package transaction, where a burdened asset is bundled with other assets that are not burdened, does invoke a seller's right of first refusal. The court also noted that two of the arguments made by Chesapeake and the seller were without merit, and those are same arguments that are made by the appellee here. One of those arguments relates to the notion of various improvements on the property and whether something would befall the buyer by getting these improvements. And what the court said in Navasota is, or the court really did not hesitate in Navasota and did not factor in the fact that Chesapeake had actually come in, drilled and completed these wells. Rather, it ordered specific performance, which is the same remedy FWCT seeks here. And the case was remanded with a determination of the value of lost revenue that Navasota had missed out on. Another issue that is similar to the one here is the value proposition. Chesapeake argued that because this leasehold acreage had been bundled with other assets, the allocation of that value in the proposed transaction did not reflect the true value. And what the court noted in Navasota and what this court should note here is that you are entitled to take the party's allocation at face value. They have in their proposal, they have split out the value for this parcel of property. If the right of first refusal was triggered off of a market value or a true value or some other standard, that might be the case. But as in Navasota, the right of first refusal here states that the right holder is entitled to exercise on the same terms and conditions.
Mr. Dreyas, did your client make an offer to purchase the package of this transaction?
Your Honor,
$14.5 million.
Your Honor, it was $15.5 million.
And so your client has recognized that there is a value to the package transaction greater than the amounts of dollars that have been allocated in the contract to just the land part of the lease with an option to purchase. Isn't that right?
That is true, Your Honor. And in fact, that situation was addressed in the Tenneco case.
Yes, and in the Tenneco case, let's go to the West Texas case. In the West Texas case, when Valero was shown to have known about the issues involving the Federal Trade Commission and held to the context of you knew about this and therefore you can't complain about it, tell me why that doesn't apply to your client.
I think in West Texas, Your Honor, a couple of distinctions are that West Texas involved one asset, not a package, is one distinction. Another distinction is that Valero in the West Texas case had twice confirmed in a stock purchase agreement the condition or precondition of FTC approval. It wanted to go back on its own deal. Now, FWT's proposal, while it might have provided a specific allocation, which I would note is not in the record anywhere, we don't know how FWT allocated, no enforceable contract was created. And in Tenneco, the court says, and I believe that proposal is also embodied in the Foster case, that prior negotiations do not invoke nor do they waive preferential rights. So FWT should not be penalized, at least according to the case law, for previously negotiating and previously making an offer.
Well, the analysis in the case before the court is really what is meant by the use of the phrase terms and conditions in the deed, isn't it, Mr. Dreyas?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
And therefore, if terms and conditions includes a payment of a market value for the 6 acres as it's been improved, how can you not give cognizance to the fact that there is a tremendous improvement of that property by what's happened with the building of the plant and the use of the plant over years on the 6 acres?
Your Honor, the value in that those improvements would be relevant to anyone who decided to operate. We don't know whether when that original conveyance occurred, FWT gave them a deal. We don't know what other terms and conditions there were. All we know is that FWT, according to the rights in this, is entitled to purchase the property and the property alone for the terms and conditions offered by the third party.
Can you buy the property without the improvements?
I think you would default. You can, Your Honor.
And
you
would. How can you get those improvements off of there?
You would default to whatever real property law provides as it relates to fixtures and immovables. If FWT has no intent of operating a galvanizing plant, those improvements have no value to FWT.
Would you consider the improvements to be permanent improvements?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar enough with the improvements to answer that question for the court. It certainly sounds like it based on the appellee's description.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
Sorry, Your Honor?
Thank you for answering my question.
Your Honor, the The cases relied on by Haskin in this case all turn back to this default rule that the court should enforce the party's bargain. West Texas Transmission, as we discussed, the notion that Valero had already agreed to the FTC approval condition was simply confirmed by the court. The exact matching requirement set forth in that case doesn't give a party like Haskin the right to lump in and heap in all these various terms and conditions, and then the demand that the right holder exactly match those terms and conditions, when the contract at issue discussed one thing and one thing only, and that is the property. Tenneco confirms that not only the point that prior negotiations do not trigger the right of first refusal, but also that courts are going to strictly construe the rights of the parties set forth in their written agreement. They're sophisticated parties. They're presumed to have known what they were doing when they signed their agreement. Tenneco was a golden opportunity for the Supreme Court to discuss West Texas Transmission, yet for 19 years, there has been no real adoption of that case in Texas by Texas courts. There's two cases that Haskin relies on for that proposition. One is the Texas State Optical versus Wiggins decision. That is an appeal from an injunction, and the dissent in that case takes issue with the fact that the Court of Appeals essentially made new law in hearing an appeal on an injunction. Shell versus Austin Rehearsal Center is likewise not persuasive. It's an unpublished decision out of Austin, and there the court did not need to even reach the issue of the West Texas transmission factors. West Texas Transmission has also been rejected squarely by the Amarillo Court, the Eastland Court, and the Waco Court.
So, counsel, it appears to me the law in Texas is not settled on this area. You're asking us to make a choice. Perhaps there's one prevailing view, but there's also a minority view. Tell us the policy reasons why your view should prevail with this court, since we don't have the Supreme Court telling us which way to go on this decision.
I think the policy reason, Your Honor, is certainty in contract rights and enforcing the well-settled rule that parties are held to their bargains. There are two rules, the minority rule and the majority rule, as it relates to these package transactions. The distinction that Haskin makes, I think, is the wrong distinction. What those rules focus on is whether or not a package conveyance triggers the right of first refusal on a smaller included burden parcel. Under the majority rule in other states, they hold typically that package conveyance does not trigger the right, but the right holder is not left without a remedy in those cases. In those cases, the right holder is entitled to either enjoin the sale, or if the sale has been completed, there is typically a reconveyance of the burden property. The majority rule in Texas holds that the package conveyance does trigger the right. And I would take the position, Your Honor, the law is settled in that there has been uniformity amongst the appellate courts as how they treat this issue. Navasota provides a good overview of how all of these cases have been disposed of. And in all of those cases, the key points are that, one, the preferential right is triggered by the proposed package sale. Two, that while the right holder cannot be forced to accept the package, the right holder can likewise not force the seller to convey more than is burdened by the right. And then the final bit of uniformity amongst the Texas cases is that specific performance is the proper remedy. Your Honor, I'll conclude now with turning back to the contract. One contract between two parties covering one piece of property. FWT had the right to buy or lease that property on the same terms that a third-party purchaser offered. Valmont made an offer for the property and an offer on other assets. That offer for the property was well-defined, the price was set forth, and Haskin then presented to FWT notice of that offer and a request that FWT waive it. FWT simply wants the rights it was provided under that contract. Haskin wants to rewrite the contract. They want this court to assume it includes improvements, that it includes a market value measure, or that it gives Haskin the right to escape the right by making a package conveyance. That's not what the agreement says. Haskin says FWT's position in this case is untenable. Texas courts have never held that holding a party to the terms of their bargain is untenable. and rejection of that principle would make new law. Haskins' proposed new law would create a fact issue in all contracts and all rights of first refusal because the court would be looking beyond. The trial court here erred because it did consider parole evidence. And with no pleading of ambiguity by any party, that was an error to consider that evidence. This court should reject the level of uncertainty that's proposed by Haskins for contract and property rights in the state of Texas. Appellant asks that the court reverse the judgment of the trial court, render judgment in FWT's favor for both declaratory relief and for specific performance, and remand the case on the issue of attorney's fees.
Thank you, Mr. Drez. Mr. Smith.
May it please the court. My name is Kobe Smith, and along with Joe Cleveland, I represent the appellee, Haskins Wallace Property Management Company, in this case. Now, Haskins Wallace is owned by these three gentlemen, Greg Haskins, Russell Wallace, and Jim Mason. The facts of this case are pretty simple. These three gentlemen own the Kennedale property through their property management company. These same three gentlemen built and operate a multi-million dollar galvanizing business on that property. Now, they also operate a smaller galvanizing business in Hearst, and they made the decision that they wanted to sell out of the galvanizing business. When they did this, they solicited and received several bid proposals from various entities, including one bid proposal, as Justice Meyer pointed out, a $15.5 million proposal from Fort Worth Tower. Fort Worth Tower didn't win in the bidding process. Valmont's bid of $16.5 million was the highest bid. Now, the reason we're here today is because Fort Worth Tower now, having failed in that bid process, is attempting to selectively exercise their right of first refusal to scuttle the Valmont transaction. Throughout their brief and their reply brief, and even here today, Fort Worth Tower argues that the right of first refusal is created by the deed. And they argue that we are trying to rewrite that deed. That's simply not true. We agree that the right of first refusal is created by the deed. Fort Worth Tower wants to focus on the pricing concept of that right of first refusal, but they want to ignore the terms and conditions language included in that right of first refusal. If you look at the right of first refusal, what it says is that once Haskins Wallace decides to sell or lease the property, and once they receive a bona fide offer from a third party, then they have to give Fort Worth Tower notice of that proposed transaction. We did that in this case. Once Fort Worth Tower receives that notice, they have 20 days to elect to either purchase, lease, or otherwise accept such conveyance as the case may be at the same price, and I quote, and under the same terms and conditions offered by the prospective purchaser. That's the portion that's at issue in this case here today. In the case, Valmont is the third-party purchaser. The terms and conditions of their proposed purchase were included in the notice letter that was provided to Fort Worth Tower, and that's included in the record at pages, at the clerk's record at pages 16 through 20. That notice that sets out the terms of the Valmont offer specifically states, the transaction, as contemplated by the parties, is contingent in nature, and the relevant components are not mutually exclusive. It also says all are contingent on the whole. It goes on another page in the same notice letter and says, with respect to the sale or lease of the property, or with respect to the sale or lease of the property, that notice letter states, and I quote, it should be noted that the closing of the transaction in its entirety is subject to the delivery of the Hearst property sublease and the Kennedale property lease. The point is, this was an all or nothing transaction. Now, Fort Worth Tower contends that they seek to purchase the property or lease the property on the same terms and conditions as Valmont. That's simply not true. Valmont could never have purchased this property or leased this property without going through with the entire transaction and purchasing the galvanizing businesses. In fact, Fort Worth Tower has never argued that Valmont could have purchased or leased this property without going through with the entire transaction. So the question before the court today is whether Fort Worth Tower can now selectively exercise its right of first refusal and not comply with all of the terms and conditions of the Valmont offer. The property deed, as it's worded, answers that question no. The property deed that they're relying upon says Fort Worth Tower, to purchase or lease the property, has to do it at the same price and under the same terms and conditions offered by the prospective purchaser. That's what the deed, the contract that created this right, says. And a fair and reasonable interpretation of Texas law also answers the question no. They cannot exercise that right without going through the entire transaction. Fort Worth Tower argues in their brief and in their reply brief, and again today, that no Texas case has ever required a right holder to purchase assets beyond the subject property to exercise their right of first refusal. But what Fort Worth Tower ignores is that no Texas case has ever addressed a situation like we have here today, where you have the property and you have a multi-million dollar business operating directly on top of that property. In other words, Fort Worth Tower has totally ignored the elephant in the room, the hard question in this case. What happens to that $12.5 million business if they get to selectively exercise their right of first refusal? They didn't answer this question in the trial court. They didn't answer it in their brief. They didn't answer it in their reply brief, and they haven't answered it here today. Now, I propose to you that the only fair and reasonable way to answer the question in this case is to apply the commercial reasonableness test that's set forth by the Fifth Circuit and West Texas Transmission, and that's also adopted by the Houston Court of Appeals First District in the Texas State Optical case and the Austin Court in the Shell case. This test, this commercial reasonableness test, is a simple three-part test. As long as Valmont's offer was commercially reasonable, was imposed in good faith, and was not designed to defeat Fort Worth Tower's right of first refusal, then Fort Worth Tower was required to match all of the terms and conditions of that offer. Now, what's interesting is Fort Worth Tower has never challenged the commercial reasonableness of this offer. They have never said that the terms were commercially unreasonable. They have never said that the terms were imposed in bad faith. And they have never alleged that the terms were imposed to defeat their right of first refusal. In fact, they can't make that argument because they themselves were presented with the offer, with the opportunity to bid on this proposal, and they bid $15.5 million. Now, because they cannot challenge the commercial reasonableness or the good faith of the terms and conditions of the transaction, they instead argue that contrary to the deed, they do not have to comply with all the terms and conditions of Valmont's offer. But to reach this conclusion, they rely upon cases that are very different from the case here today. They rely most heavily on the Navasota case out of the Waco Court of Appeals. Now, I would point out that counsel is correct. Petition has been denied. A rehearing was filed and is pending. But also I would point out that as opposed to out of hand denying that motion for rehearing, the Texas Supreme Court has taken what I consider a little bit of an unusual step in requesting a response to that motion for rehearing. They requested that, I believe, on February the 23rd or 24th, somewhere in that neighborhood. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to change their mind, but I would point out it's still pending, and that is a little bit unusual.
Well, we don't know what the Supreme Court thinks. A pet deny really doesn't tell us one way or another.
I agree with the...
I think we'd all be... should be wary of reading too much into a pet deny.
I would agree with Your Honor on that point. The other thing I would say, or there are several other things I'd say about Navasota. First off, in attempting to distinguish West Texas Transmission, the Navasota court pointed out that the condition at issue in West Texas Transmission directly related to the sale of the interest in the pipeline as opposed to some unrelated asset. In other words, the Navasota court viewed the assets that were involved in that case as unrelated to the property at hand. That's not what we have in our case. We've got a $12.5 million business owned by the same owners that own the property that's operating directly on top of the property. It would be impossible for these gentlemen to sell that galvanizing business without either also selling the property to the purchaser or providing them with a long-term lease that's sufficient in length for them to recoup their investment. Nobody is going to come in and purchase that galvanizing business without that security. The other thing I would point out about the Navasota case, and perhaps most importantly about why that case is different than this case, is there was huge problems with the notice letter in that case. The original notice to Navasota Resources said that all they have to do to exercise their right of first refusal was pay $700 per acre and 44% of the cost through casing point for the first six deep wells in order to exercise the option. Navasota Resources got that offer. They accepted it. After they accepted it, First Source and Chesapeake came back in and said, oh, wait a minute, in addition, you've got to purchase 19.9% of our stock, and you've got to enter into this agreement for an area of mutual interest in 13 counties in East Texas. The Navasota court correctly held that you can't do that. You can't make your offer, have them accept it, and then come back in and change the terms. We didn't do that. The notice letter that was sent to Fort Worth Tower in December of 2007 included all of the terms and conditions. That's what Valmont had offered, and that's what Fort Worth Tower was required to match to exercise their right of first refusal. Now, one other distinction between Navasota and the present case is there's no indication that that was an all-or-nothing transaction. The evidence in our case clearly indicates that it's an all-or-nothing transaction. West Texas Transmission, just real briefly, I would point out that in that case, the right holder also tried to argue that all they had to do was comply with the price component to exercise their right of first refusal. The Fifth Circuit said no, and they pointed out the language in the right of first refusal. They said to be exercised, it had to be exercised on the same, and this is a quote, on the same terms and conditions as set forth in a third-party offer or agreement to purchase. That language is eerily similar to the language in our deed. Now, they pointed out that argued that the Amarillo Court has rejected West Texas Transmission. I don't believe that's an accurate reading of the Abraham case out of Amarillo, and it's discussed in a footnote in our brief. I believe that what Abraham did is they questioned whether West Texas Transmission was based on Texas law, and then they said, we don't even have to consider those three factors because there was fraud involved in Abraham that resulted in the option holder not being able to exercise their option, and they said Texas law already protects against that. So we don't even have to consider the West Texas Transmission factors. They did not reject the case. And I think the Texas State Optical case, what I would point out is I believe, although the dissent questioned what they were doing with respect to an injunction, the dissent did not reject West Texas Transmission and those three factors. The other cases that are relied upon by Fort Worth Tower are discussed in detail in our brief. They're all distinguishable. Two of them never even reached the issue of whether the option holder could be required to purchase additional assets beyond the property. And one of them actually supports our position because it specifically held that you could not force the property owner to sell the smaller piece without buying the entire piece, because there's no indication they wanted to do that. So I think the Hines case actually supports us as well. Now, I believe that the Texas State Optical case and the Austin Shell case and the Fifth Circuit West Texas Transmission case answers the question in this case, and that is that this transaction was commercially reasonable, it was in good faith, it wasn't designed to defeat their right, so they were required to meet all of the terms and conditions. I think that's the end of the question for the court.
But the commercial reasonableness test doesn't obviate or supplant the terms of the contract that the parties entered into, does it? I mean, you can't say that because the offer was commercially reasonable, therefore the express terms of the contract don't apply or are not a factor in the decision, can you? I mean, that's not what the Fifth Circuit meant.
I agree, Your Honor. If our deed had read that they have to match the price of the proposal for the property, and that was the end of the discussion. And then we included this transaction as it is. I don't think the commercial reasonableness test would set aside that contract language that says you've got to comply and match the price. The point is, the deed doesn't say you've got to comply and match the price. The deed says you have to match the price and all terms and conditions. That's where the commercial reasonableness test comes in, to address whether these terms and conditions are commercially reasonable, are in good faith, or are they designed to defeat the right of first refusal. That's the distinction. If all this was about price, the commercial reasonableness test wouldn't be involved. But the deed doesn't limit it to price. The deed says you've got to match all terms and conditions. And I think, as I said, that's the end of the discussion. But they've argued for specific performance, and I real briefly want to say, even if you get past the commercial reasonableness test, they are not entitled to specific performance. Texas law says that's an equitable remedy. Now, what does that mean? They have to act in good faith. You can read our brief about the facts that they talk about being parole evidence. The point of that is to defeat, and it was filed in a response to their summary judgment, was to defeat their claim. Also, it can't
the deed,
operate.
Counsel, the deed also specifically refers to property, but it doesn't refer to improvements. And it's the property that's the object of the right of first refusal. Is where in the deed or any of the documents that are relevant to this, is there any reference to improvements on the property in addition to the property?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor, but I come back to the express language of the right of first refusal that says you've got to purchase that property on the same terms and conditions as a third-party offer.
Thank you.
This commercial reasonableness test
Thank
protects
you,
both sides.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Mr. Dres.
Your Honor, there's been no dispute that the right was triggered, that the right was exercised, and that the deed covers only the property. Do the appellees Haskin here get to expand the definition of terms and conditions to include things beyond the property? In other words, can they expand the scope of that agreement by use of the phrase terms and conditions? While it's true that Navasota is an intermediate court opinion, that there is a petition for the rehearing is pending, Navasota, Riley, Foster, McMillan, Hines, all of these cases say the exact same thing. And I would respectfully disagree with counsel that the Hines decision supports their position in that case, because I believe what the court said in Hines is sort of the flip side of what's going on here, and that is just as FWT cannot be forced to accept more than it bargained for in its contract, FWT likewise could not use its contract to expand what its preferential right covers. So if the rule is as Haskin suggests, and a party can be forced to accept more or waive its right of first refusal, then the reverse must also be true. And that is the policy reason for causing these parties to strictly comply with the terms of their agreement. The notion that all is contingent on the whole was made in all of these cases. The same argument was made in the Navasota decision. I believe the same argument was made in McMillan. And the real problem in McMillan, and I think what illustrates the problem with accepting Haskin's position, is in McMillan, you had multiple preferential rights burdening multiple properties. How would that package conveyance have affected those various preferential rights? And the court said, no, you can't do it. You can't get around that preferential right. This party's not without a remedy. Jones versus Gibbs, an old case, says that parties can get around things, a right of first refusal or something of this nature, on a pleading of fraud, accident, or mistake. The court has no pleading in the record by Haskin that supports any finding of fraud, accident, or mistake. They don't allege it here. It is true that it is an all-or-nothing proposal. The all-or-nothing proposal is the position advocated by Haskin. You either buy everything, you accept our terms and conditions, or you have nothing. That completely disembowels the value of the preferential right that FWT had in this case. It means nothing because this party can arbitrarily bundle these assets and get around the preferential right. Regardless of whether
Is that what they're doing? Are you telling us that they are arbitrarily bundling these rights?
to the extent, Your Honor, they include these various assets among the terms and conditions.
You mean the other parts of the business in Hearst? That's arbitrarily bundling them?
I think it is, Your Honor, to the extent it's designed to escape the preferential right in this case.
But, counsel, that's an assumption that you make there, that is the purpose of including these other assets, and I don't know that the record actually reflects that. That's almost, accusing the other party of some type of fraud or deceit or deception.
Certainly not what I meant, Your Honor. I think that that accusation has been levied against FWT in this case, so
sure
I guess
has.
It works both ways. My point is they can't, and excuse me if I stated it too strongly, my point is they don't get to force an all-or-nothing proposal on FWT. And even if the commercial reasonableness test did apply in Texas, does it then entitle them to a presumption of commercial reasonableness? There was no finding by the trial court that the transaction at issue was commercially reasonable.
The correction warranty deed is dated September the 8th of 1997. At that time, what improvements were on the six-acre tract?
Your Honor, I believe the record is, according to evidence tendered by Haskin, is there was nothing on that tract.
In other words, it's vacant land.
That's true, Your Honor.
And then when this offer is made to purchase the property, it's got a multimillion-dollar galvanizing plant on it. And you're wanting, your client is in position to saying, we want to pay for the land again, but we don't want to pay for the galvanizing plant.
Your Honor, I think we don't know the terms of that transaction. We don't know the value of that land because it is contiguous to FWT's other property.
Well, now, didn't you make an offer for the whole package?
True, Your Honor, and we go back to Tenneco.
$15.5 million, so there must be some knowledge of value there.
There's Your Honor. My time has expired, barring any.
Why don't you go ahead and answer Judge Meyer's question?
Judge Meyer, I got distracted by the red light, so I'd ask you to repeat it, please. I apologize.
I just ask you if it's your client's position that you're entitled to buy the land at a price of allocation of the land within the notice letter that you got, and not to pay anything for the improvements.
According to the language of the deed, yes, Your Honor, that is our position.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Counsel, for both parties, we appreciate your appearance here this morning. The presentation of your arguments are both well done. Case is submitted, and you're all excused. Thank you very much.